This is Herb Montgomery, and I want to take this opportunity to thank all of you who are supporting the work of Renewed Heart Ministries. It's people like yourself that enable us to exist and to be a positive resource in our world in the work of survival, resistance, liberation, restoration, and transformation. If you're unfamiliar with Renewed Heart Ministries, we are a not-for-profit group that is passionate about centering a set of values and ethics in the experiences of those on the undersides and margins of our society. Informed also by the sayings and the teachings of the historical Jewish Jesus of Nazareth. If you'd like to support our work, I'll tell you how you can do so at the end of this podcast. But for now, we simply want to thank you for listening. Thank you once again for inviting me to share in your winter gospel celebration with your church this weekend. It's a privilege to be here. It's nice to see so many young people, involved, and it's nice to see so many people show up for an event like this. Thank you for valuing this weekend and making time to be here. Weren't the young people lovely this morning? How many enjoyed seeing that many young people up front? Again, thank you so much for having me. As a fellow Appalachian, this morning's topic is entitled Appalachian Jesus. And I want to begin by pointing out a dynamic that I saw taking place in this room last night. Now, I don't want you to feel singled out because you're not unique. You're special, but you're not that unique as a congregation. This is a dynamic whenever we talk about the subject that we talked about last night, Jesus' gospel, this dynamic typically takes place in the room. To understand the dynamic, we have to understand not only how Jesus' society was shaped and formed in his day, but how our society is shaped today as well. Last night, we gave the diagram. Can you see that? You might want to refresh your browser, see if that comes up. I love modern technology. There you go. Perfect. Today's society is shaped in the form of a pyramid, and pyramids, by their very shape, the majority of the people are which end of the pyramid? The bottom. The least amount of people are at which end? For whose benefit is the pyramid functioning? For whose benefit is it structured? The top. At whose expense is it working for, against? The bottom. Many of us here in Appalachia work really hard to live somewhere right around here, which means we're not lower class, so to speak. There are a lot of lower class within Appalachia. If you agree with that, say yes. But the majority of us work really hard just to get over that line. And we've worked really hard for just the little bit that we have. How many would resonate with that? Now, let me back up and talk to you about another dynamic. The further you go up this pyramid, the less taxes you end up paying. How many have noticed that? You get more loopholes, right? Now, let me back out of last night's presentation and just talk about the reality we live in for a moment. The further up you go, the less taxes you pay, which means when we start talking about helping the poor, typically what we hear is this is just another person at the top telling me I've got to share the little bit that I have with those at the bottom, while these people up here end up paying less and less and less and less. And there's a little bit of resentment and resistance to hearing about helping the poor one more time. How many can resonate with that? Did anybody, I saw it last night. I don't know if anybody has enough courage to admit it. How many know that's what was happening in the room last night? Did anyone see it happening? Some of you have the courage to admit that's what's happening. And what ends up happening is those at the top of our society, they play, Christians in the middle class are getting played. Because what they do is they create a structure where a little bit of charity is given to those at the bottom at these people's expense. Are you with me? Are you still with me? A little bit of charity to these people at the bottom at these people's expense. And the challenge with charity is that charity really doesn't change anything. Are you with me? Charity too often is just riot insurance. Does that make sense? It keeps these people at the bottom with just enough that they don't protest, that they don't riot. But who pays for it? Be honest, who pays for it? The middle class. And especially within the middle class, who pays for it the most? Those at the lower sections of the middle class. Are you with me? So when Christians who belong to the lower sections of the middle class, which is most of those of you here in this room, whenever you hear Jesus' message to help the poor, because of the world you live in and the conditioning, the socializing that we grow up with, we initially have a resistance to that gospel. Are you with me? And so those who claim to love Jesus the most are the ones that are the most resistant to actually following him. Let me back up and share with you a little bit of the differences. The prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures did not call for charity. They called for justice. Do you understand the difference? Now, don't misunderstand me. If someone's drowning in the river in front of you, the compassionate thing to do is what? It's pull them out. Is there a place for charity? Yeah, some people don't have time to wait for structural and systemic change. They need help today just to get through today. Are you with me? That's a reality in Appalachia. But at some point, we have to pull our eyes off of those that are drowning right in front of us and walk up the stream and ask, who's throwing them in to begin with? Are you hearing me? That's what the prophets called for. What Jesus called for is not, notice in the Jesus stories, there's very little said to the lower class or to the middle class. And you're going to see that this morning. Jesus' message is good news to those at the bottom of the pyramid. Good news to the poor. That's what we read last night. It's problematic for those at the top, but it's a restructuring of the entire pyramid that the prophets called, again, justice. It's a brand new world. Jesus asked for something different than what the middle class is usually burdened with. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think the middle class have drank the upper class's Kool-Aid. Because which direction are we trying to move into? Which direction, which section of the pyramid do we want to reach one day? And they let just enough of you through that process to make the rest of you believe it's possible. Jesus called those in the middle class to abandon the pyramid class structure and to stand in solidarity with those at the bottom, not in a way that protects the pyramid. Are you hearing me? That just costs you. But in a way that transforms the entire thing into what Jesus called a shared table. It's a radical social vision. And this was the heart of Jesus' gospel. Follow with me in your handouts. What I'm going to share with you this morning is what is called affectionately Appalachian liberation theology. It is an Appalachian Jesus. Here in Appalachia, we have some of the most startling statistics in the United States. Entire counties within Appalachia have the lowest life expectancy rates in the nation. They rival developing countries. We have some of the lowest education rates in the nation. We have counties where less than half the population finishes high school and only 5% of the adult population go on to finish some level of college. What percentage of the population? Some of you are not following well. If you need a handout, please raise your hand. We will get you one quickly if you need one. Sam's passing them out. Thanks, Sam. In a nation that touts being the wealthiest country in history, we cannot ignore that over 43 million live in poverty. In Appalachia, we are home to counties where over half the county lives below the poverty line. As I said last night, there are some cities in the state that I live in where the entire city population lives below the poverty line. This is a region of the country where unemployment reaches record highs. Drug addiction is an epidemic in Appalachia. And our schools continue to struggle from not receiving adequate funding. In my state of West Virginia, one out of every four children, the only meal that child will eat are those meals they eat at school. That's not. That means where most kids are happy for a snow day, those kids don't get to eat on snow days. Man, if that doesn't tug at your heart, are you hearing me? What does Jesus have to offer Appalachia? In Luke 6, 20 through 26, this is where I'd like to turn this morning, because this is the gospel Jesus preached. We have to be very wary of a gospel that is only fixated on attaining heaven and deeply addicted to prioritizing guilt alleviation. If all you know about Jesus is how he saves you from your guilt and how he gives you a ticket to postmortem bliss, I want to introduce you this morning to Appalachian Jesus. Luke 6, 20 through 26, looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are what? Poor." Now let's be honest. It is not a blessing to be poor. Are you hearing me? So what is Jesus talking about? Nobody, as I said last night, nobody's working really hard to be poor. He's not saying become poor so that you can be blessed. And we have to be careful, because this passage has been used by those at the top to keep people at the bottom passive in response to their suffering. It's a blessing to be poor. And so you're socialized into being content with not even having enough to survive. I had a wealthy person say to me recently, true story, you can't make this stuff up. He said, "Well, Herb, I don't want to help the poor, because if I help them, they won't be poor anymore, and I'll take away their status of being blessed." Jesus isn't saying become poor so that you can be blessed. He's saying, listen, if the present structure leaves you in poverty, you are going to be especially blessed by the changes I've come to make. The kingdom belongs to you. Do you see the difference? It's a subtle difference. Blessed are you who are hungry now. One out of four children. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be satisfied by the changes I've come to make. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. There's nothing wrong with laughing. Are you hearing me? But if your rejoicing comes at the expense of others, blessed are you when people hate you and they exclude you and they insult you and they reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. By the way, whenever you start talking about this stuff and you start pointing this stuff out and you talked about what Jesus actually had to say about the here and now, there will be people that hate you. Now, don't get me wrong. If you're hated, that doesn't mean you're on the right path. Are you with me? You could just be a jerk. But I'm telling you this, if you start preaching what Jesus preached and you start standing up to the exploitation of the poor in our world today, you will be hated. There will be evil spoken against you. You will be excluded. And which section of the population do you think is going to hate you, feel it excludes you, and call you evil, a threat? Which end of the pyramid? Those at the top. How many would agree that Jesus once again was preaching the gospel? Jesus preaching the good news. But did Herod, Pilate, and Caiaphas hear what Jesus preached as good news? No. They said Jesus was dangerous. He was evil. And then he says, rejoice. Leap for joy. Because great is your reward in heaven. That is how their ancestors treated the prophets. The prophets are not those who predicted the future. That's a Greek definition of prophet. The Hebrew definition of prophet were those who stood in solidarity with those at the bottom, speaking for God, speaking truth to those in power. That's what a prophet was. And most of them lost their lives for it. Do you remember the last prophet in the Hebrew scriptures before Jesus? Who was he? John the Baptist. And what was his fate? He was beheaded. Why? Because he spoke truth to who? To Herod. Then Jesus turns and says, woe to you who are rich. Let me say one more thing about those who speak truth. If you start speaking out about this and you start talking about the same things Jesus talked about, there you will get pushback. But when you do, when you step into that stream of calling for not charity, but justice, you're not the first one in that stream. That's what Jesus is saying, is that stream flows way back before you. The prophets before you did the same thing, and that stream flows far beyond you in the future. When you step into that and you get that pushback, you're not alone. You're standing in good company. There have been greats who have stood where you stand. Consider it all joy when you're hated for the right reasons. Now, if those at the bottom hate you, you're in a different story. If those at the top hate you, that's a good sign. Not a guarantee, but good sign. Woe to you who are rich, for you've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go what? Hungry. Again, the middle class resists this. Do you feel it in the room right now? Jesus isn't talking to you. He's talking to which end of the pyramid? Those that are well fed right now. I'm not talking about the best of Appalachia. I'm talking about those that are well fed in society. Those whose well fedness, those whose laughter comes at the expense of the rest of the population. Some would say how blessed America is materialistically. And I would argue it is not the blessing of the divine. If your wealth comes at the exploitation of the rest of the globe, and folks in Appalachia should know the difference. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Nothing wrong with laughing. It's when your laughter comes because of the exploitation of another. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. Jesus' radical new world was a dismantling of this pyramid where people at all sections of the pyramid started taking responsibility for other people, where people take care of people. How many were here last night and you saw that? Where people take care of people. And that's going to be the higher up you go in the pyramid, the more you're going to struggle with that. For those of you at the bottom, you hear this as good news. To those at the top, you hear this as problematic because it feels threatening to you. And I would encourage those of you in the middle class, stop drinking the Kool-Aid of those at the top and join Jesus in solidarity with those at the bottom. He said, I know you're afraid that you won't have enough to eat. I know you're afraid that you've worked hard to get the little bit that you've got. I hear you. But Jesus says, don't be afraid of losing all of that for standing in solidarity with them. Because if we work for more than charity, if we work for justice, we're going to transform this thing so much. Jesus, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, not getting to some post-mortem heaven, the kingdom of heaven here on earth, God's reign on earth, where people have each other's back, where people take care of one another. And when we've reached that, then all of these things you're worried about going without, all these things will be added unto you. Amen. Because we've got more than hoarded wealth. We've got each other. Amen. This is why Jesus' gospel was such good news, and why for the first 100 years of Christianity was largely comprised of just poor people. Those are the people that resonate with this kind of news. It was Luke's shared table. Gustavo Gutierrez, author of A Theology of Liberation, he wrote, and I think he's writing to the economic situation in South America, but I think it's applicable as well to Appalachia. The poor person does not exist as an inescapable fact of destiny. His or her existence is not politically neutral, and it is not ethically innocent. The poor are a byproduct of the system in which we live and for which we are responsible. They are marginalized by our social and cultural world. They are the oppressed, the exploited proletariat, robbed of the fruit of their labor, despoiled of their humanity. Hence, the poverty of the poor is not a call to generous relief action. What is generous relief action? We've used the word already this morning. What would you call that? Charity. It's not a call to generous relief action, but a demand that we go and build a different social order. Isn't that what the early church did? There was not a needy person among them. How many would love it if forget the world, how about just in Page County there was not a needy person among you? How many would love that? A few words from Peter Gomes if you flip over on the back, and I won't hold you much longer. I know three sessions that we have, we've packed a lot into them. And I want to be sensitive to how long you've been seated. But these words from Peter Gomes, I think, are applicable to us as Appalachians. When the gospel says the last will be first and the first will be last, despite the fact that it's counterintuitive to our cultural presuppositions, it is invariably good news to those that are last. It is at least problematic news to those who see themselves as first. The good news to some will almost inevitably be bad news to others. In order that the gospel in the New Testament might be made as palatable as possible and to as many as possible, its rough edges have been shorn off, and the radical edge of Jesus' preaching has been replaced by a respectable middle, of which niceness is now God. What does he mean by that? If we define the gospel as only attaining heaven and alleviating those at the top of the pyramid of their guilt, helping them sleep at night, no condemnation. If we define our gospel just as no condemnation and a ticket to heaven, notice what we're doing. We're shoring off the rough edges of Jesus' radical teachings, and we're trying to make it as palatable as possible for everyone. Are you hearing me? Because don't we want everyone to go to heaven? Yes. But Jesus was not primarily concerned with getting everyone into heaven. Jesus was primarily concerned with getting the liberation of heaven into the lives of those who are suffering here, now, today. That should be a louder amen. But I hear you. I understand what social location we belong to this morning. These words are a little bit challenging even to us. But Jesus gives us hope. We got to believe in one another. We are so individualistic, so self-sufficient. We rely on ourselves to get us through in the future. Jesus says, let me show you a better way. Your hope is not in your ability to provide for yourself. Your hope is in your commitment to take care of your fellow human being. Jesus' message was one of survival. For those at the bottom, sharing meant survival. Are you with me? People taking care of people. It was a way for them to pool the little bit of resources they had together and stop striving on their own and do it together as a community. Jesus' gospel solution for those at the bottom was community, not charity. It is impossible to follow Jesus all by yourself. You can't do it because most of his teachings revolve around how to properly do community. That's like asking a chef. Doing it by yourself is like asking a chef to make a fine meal without any ingredients. Community provides the ingredients to actually put Jesus' teachings into practice. It was one of resistance. We'll talk about that more in a moment. Jesus did not teach the oppressed to just be doormats to those at the top. How many are thankful to hear that Jesus isn't teaching you to be a doormat? By the way, Jesus has been co-opted by those at the top too often to make those at the bottom a doormat. Jesus' message was one not just of survival, but also liberation. It was of restoration, and it was of transformation, a dynamic that we have to understand. How many have heard this argument within upper class Christianity? Is it easy to be saved or is it hard to be saved? How many have heard that argument before? You've grown up maybe with that. And some will say, well, it's easy to be saved. And some will say it's hard to be saved. I would like to suggest to you that Jesus wasn't, again, talking about saved in the sense of postmortem bliss. He was talking about his new social order called the kingdom. And it's both hard and easy. What makes the difference? We'll look at the screen for a moment. Who would find it difficult? To move from a pyramid, not to a flipped pyramid, but to a shared table. Who would find it difficult to share in the pyramid? Who would find it easy? So whether it's easy or hard, maybe the dynamic, the whole discussion can be solved by just asking, from what social location are we beginning? In Luke 18, 22 through 24, Jesus heard this and said to him, "You still lack one thing. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven." He's not talking to you, the middle class. He's talking to those at the top. "Then come follow me." And when he heard this, that he became very sad because he was very wealthy. Do you see that? That's the top. And Jesus looked at him and said, "How? What's the word?" Now, is Jesus lying? It was hard for him, wasn't it? Let's be honest. But then look at the next passage in Matthew 11, 28 through 30. "Come unto me, all you who are" what? "Weary." And you're carrying what? "Heavy burdens, and I will give you" what? Which section of the pyramid is that? Yeah, those who are laboring under the weight of this thing. "Take my yoke upon you, learn of me, for I'm gentle and humble of heart, and you'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke is" what? The yoke of this is hard, but my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, I do want to add one qualification this morning before we're done. And that is that it is too easy to look at the present structure and for those at the bottom to turn against those at the top, to feel hatred in their hearts for those at the top, to feel condemnation in their hearts for those at the top. Jesus' shared table is about restoring the humanity of how many in the pyramid? All. And how many are thankful that God loves those at the top too? How many are thankful for that? That everyone's humanity needs restored from what we've created. So Jesus then turns, and in the very next passage in Luke, he says, "But to you who are listening to this, blessed are you who are poor, and woe to you who are rich." Those of you at the top are going to struggle. Those of you at the bottom are going to leap for joy. "But to you who are listening, I say, don't forget, love your enemies. Do good to those that hate you. When people at the top feel threatened by you, do good to them." That's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because most revolutions, what do we want to do? We don't want to stop at the shared table. What do we want to do in most revolutions? We want to keep going and flip it all the way over to now we're on the top and they're on the bottom. Am I right? That doesn't solve anything. That just perpetuates the problem. It just gives you a new oppressed and a new oppressor. "Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." And let me tell you, it's hard. I love the passage that says, "Blessed are you when people hate you." I hate the passage that says, "Pray for those hating you." Can I be honest this morning? It's hard. There's a lot of people out there that don't like me. And part of them rightly so. But some of them not rightly so. And it is hard to pray for those. Now you get it. If someone slaps you on one cheek, man, I hate this. What's he say to do? Turn the other one. Now be careful. A lot is lost if we don't understand the cultural background of this. If I could just take just a few more minutes of your time. Matthew's version is clearer. If everyone slaps you on the right cheek, you have to understand the culture. In this culture, it was unclean to do anything with your left hand. This was before indoor plumbing, not to be graphic. Outhouse users still? Are you hearing me? People can't buy. My dad's got a cabin out in the woods. People that I run into across the globe can't believe that I live in the 21st century and my parents still have an outhouse. It's true. At least at one of their properties, it's true. It was unclean to do it. You couldn't even gesture. You couldn't even wave at Uncle Joe across the road with your left hand without receiving a fine, a monetary fine in that culture. You were not to have any other human, no interaction, relational interaction with the left hand. With me? Unclean. That was the hand you did unclean things with. Now, if you're going to strike someone on the right cheek, everybody take your right hand. And which cheek up here is my right cheek? Which one? Point to it. Which cheek? This one over here? This one? I don't know my left from my right. This one? Take your right hand and strike me on the right cheek. Just pretend to. You can do it. I give you permission. No, that's my left cheek. You just hit me on my left. Try my right. Yeah. Now, some of you have got it. Some of you are still doing gymnastics. Nobody hits like this. If you get upset and you're right-handed and you're going to strike someone on the right cheek and you're upset, what's the most natural way to do it? We have a term for that where I come from. The proper phrase is, that's a backhanded slap. And that slap had a connotation in Jesus' day. You would not have struck an equal that way. If you were going to strike an equal, it would have been with a closed fist and it would have landed on their left cheek. If you're going to strike someone on the right cheek, that is the way a wealthy person would have struck a poor person. It's the way, and I'm glad we live in the 21st century, not the first century, that is the way a man would have struck a woman. That is the way a master would have struck a slave. That is the way an adult would have struck a child. It was meant to communicate, get back in your place. You are out of line. And does Jesus say, strike them back? No, because too often that only escalates. What does Jesus say? Be a doormat? No, you're misunderstanding. Jesus says, if they strike you on that cheek, do what? Excuse me, if you want to hit me, that's fine. But you're going to have to do it on the proper cheek because I am your equal, not your subservient. Now, is this opening, say, for women? Is this opening women up to greater violence? No. For a man to strike a woman on her left cheek now would mean he would have to recognize she is his. And no first century Roman or Jewish man would have admitted that a woman was his equal in the first century. Are you hearing what I'm saying this morning? It was not a way to roll over and just take it. It was a way to stand up in your God-given dignity. It was not self-sacrifice. It was self-affirmation in an environment where yourself was already being denied by those who were your superiors in that culture. How many are looking at it just a little bit differently this morning than what you've seen it in the past? Just a little cultural understanding. If they sue you for one article of clothing, this is incredibly economic. If they sue you for one article of clothing, take off the other. This is a challenge. Because these are people who are so poor, they only had two articles of clothing left to their name, and this is before the invention of the Fruit of the Looms. What does that mean? In Jewish culture, remember the story of Ham? No, remember? In Jewish culture, the shame was never on the one whose nakedness was exposed. It was always on the one who, like Johnny Bench, stared at the nakedness. Remember the two brothers? They walked in backwards so as to not look upon their father's nakedness. It was shameful to look on someone's nakedness. So Jesus is saying, if you've fallen into such debt that you have to use an article of clothing to secure a loan just to survive from these wealthy, top-of-the-pyramid people, and you'd have to default on that loan, and now they're suing you not just for that, but for your other article of clothing. Something's wrong with that picture. How many would agree with that? At some point, there has to become a redistribution of that which has been hoarded. This is what Jesus is calling for. Sell it and give it. Share it. Start considering them as more value than yourself. Jesus says, this is radical. It's unconventional. It's non-domesticated. Jesus says, fine, give them not only your coat, but you take off the undergarment as well, and you stand there in your God-given dignity, stark naked in the middle of the town square being sued, as if to say to the entire system, shame on you. This is not right, whether you like it or not. Jesus endorsed public nudity as a valid form of nonviolent protest. I know. If they force you to go 1 mile, go with them too. What's that about? Don't play by the rules of your oppressors. You see, Roman soldiers could force a Jewish citizen to carry their burden originally all day long. But the problem with that is if they did that, by the end of the day, the sun was going down and you found yourself a day's journey away from your home. So Rome said, let's put some limits to this. We won't change anything. I mean, we'll still allow you to force them to carry your burdens, but we'll limit it to just 1 mile. Then you got to find someone else. So the worst your day could get is you're at 1 mile away from your home. I was just up in Canada. I don't know if the Jews use miles or kilometers. I don't know. Neither. But notice what Jesus is saying. When you get to the end of that first mile, and they ask you to take it back, realize there's a penalty. If this soldier gets caught by his superiors making you carry this burden more than 1 mile, he will be in trouble. Jesus says, when they ask you to give it back, Jesus says, tell them what? No, I'm going to walk another, sir. Who does that give control of the situation to in that moment? Puts it back into the hand of the oppressed. And it calls upon the Roman soldier to recognize the human dignity of the one they're oppressing. How many can see that Jesus was not teaching the oppressed to just be a doormat? How many are saying turn the other cheek a little differently this morning than what you've previously? How many have struggled with the turn the other cheek in the past? How many have struggled with that? How many does this give you hope for? Yeah. Now, granted, it's rooted in the desire to create an opportunity for your oppressor to change. They have to choose to regain their humanity too. It's not a guarantee. You're just creating a risky situation that opens up the possibility for a different result. If we strike back, it's just going to escalate. But Jesus was a Savior that stood in solidarity with those at the bottom, and he was teaching those at the bottom creative ways, again, to survive, to resist, to work toward their liberation, for restoration and transformation. For those of you who this is new information for, I want to encourage you to read a book by Walter Wink, the late Walter Wink, titled Jesus and Nonviolence, a Third Way. At Renewed Heart Ministries, renewedheartministries.com, that's the ministry that I'm the director of. We have a monthly book reading list. If you read all 12 books in a year, it's one book a month. If you read all 12, we send you a certificate. This month's book is Walter Wink's Jesus and Nonviolence, a Third Way. And that's where some of this historical context that we don't normally hear about was gleaned from. If you're interested in that topic, it's a book that, it's a short book. You can read it in an afternoon. It's a small book, but it's one that I think you would enjoy immensely. I'll close this morning with two other. I've said I was about to close. I've not said I was closing yet, so hear me out. What's it mean when a preacher says he's about to close? Absolutely nothing. We just see you falling asleep and we're trying to prod you along. Hang in there. These two statements and then I'm done. The one from Barbara Deming, Revolution and Equilibrium. Now this was written in the 70s. When was it written? Did you hear me say that? When was it written? Okay, that's going to be important here in a minute. It was written when? With one hand, we say to the one who is angry or to an oppressor or to an unjust system, stop what you are doing. I refuse to honor the role you are choosing to play. I refuse to obey you. I refuse to cooperate with your demands. I refuse to build the walls and the bombs. I refuse to pay for the guns. With this hand, I will interfere with the wrong you are doing. I want to disrupt the easy pattern of your life. But then the advocate of nonviolence raises the other hand. It is raised outstretched, maybe with love and sympathy, maybe not, but always outstretched. With this hand, we say, I won't let go of you or cast you out of the human race. I have faith that you can make a better choice than you are making right now. And I'll be here when you are ready. Like it or not, we are part of one another. Active nonviolence is a process that holds these two realities of non-cooperation with violence, but open to the humanity of the violator in tension. It is like saying to our opponent, on the one hand, symbolized by the hand firmly outstretched and signaling stop, I will not cooperate with your violence or injustice. And on the other, I will resist it with every fiber of my being. And on the other hand, symbolized by the hand with its palm turned open and stretched toward the other, I am still open to you as a human being. How many can see the hope for our world in this? It's not just liberation, it's restoration and transformation. Paulo Freire in Pedagogy of the Oppressed. He could write this just as well for Appalachia. In order for this struggle to have meaning, the oppressed must not, in seeking to regain their humanity, which is a way to create it, become oppressors of the oppressors, but rather restorers of the humanity of both. There are other liberations that I think Appalachia needs this morning, not just economic. Now, economic's a big problem here in Appalachia. How many would agree with that, the need for economic liberation? But there's other kinds of liberation that's needed. If we talk about gender liberation, ladies, is there a gender pyramid? We talk about the economic pyramid. Is there a gender pyramid? You can be honest this morning. Oh, yeah. And where are people like me? The top, thank you. Now the women are talking. I think we could extract principles for Jesus' economic liberation for that today as well. That's, women in Appalachia need liberated too, do they not? And not just white women. How about racial pyramid? Do we have racial pyramids in Appalachia? Oh, man. Maybe Jesus was Appalachian, not Jewish. There may be some truth to that. There's not just gender liberation, economic liberation, racial liberation. There's other liberations, aren't there? Anytime you see a structure that is hierarchical in nature, that benefits and produces safety and privilege for one end at the expense of another, Jesus' teachings become radically relevant. This is the Appalachian Jesus. He's not just concerned with where you spend your eternity. He's concerned with the quality of your life today. And he has solutions. And those solutions are not beyond your grasp. As simple as Jesus' gospel can be made, the kingdom of God is people taking care of people. Thank you once again for listening. Everything we do here at Renewed Heart Ministries is done with the purpose of making these resources as free as possible. And to do so, we need the help of people like yourself. If you'd like to support the work of Renewed Heart Ministries, you can make a one-time gift or become one of our monthly contributors by going to renewedheartministries.com and clicking on the Donate tab at the top right of the homepage. Or you can mail your contribution to Renewed Heart Ministries, P.O. Box 1211, Lewisburg, West Virginia, 24901. Make sure you also sign up for our free resources on our website, and we have a monthly newsletter that we mail out, and there's just much, much more. Remember, everything we do here at Renewed Heart Ministries is for free, and every little bit helps. And anything we receive over and above our annual budget, we happily pass on to other not-for-profits that we feel are making both systemic and personal differences in the lives of those less privileged within our status quo. And for those already supporting our work, again, thank you. Together, we are making a difference, making our world a safer, more just, more compassionate home for us all.